Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, your host, and we got a very, very special podcast in store for you. We're going to talk to one of my favorite guests. He's been a frequent guest on Health Talk, and he's joining us for the first time on Intelligent Medicine. He's got a brand new book, tremendously exciting. He is America's foremost integrative neurologist. He's none other than Dr. David Perlmutter, and in a few days, he will be releasing yet another fabulous book. And David, I'm so jealous of your title. That's just a brilliant title. It's a real grabber. It's called Grain Brain. And shall I list your illustrious qualifications?
Let me just say that with my publisher, I was going to say My Life with Ron Hoffman, but they didn't think it would have as much traction as Grain Brain. So there you go.
You know those publishers. They just don't, you know, they just don't have any imagination. For purposes of documenting, Dr. Perlmutter is a board-certified neurologist. He practices in Florida, and he's a fellow of the American College of Nutrition. He received his MD degree from the University of Miami Medical School. He is in Naples, Florida, currently, and he is frequently called upon to lecture at medical conferences. He's one of the foremost educators in the field of integrative medicine. And he's received all kinds of awards. He's written some fantastic scientific articles as well as popular books. He's looked to as a real leader in this field. And he's been on many popular TV programs, including Fox and Friends, CNN, Oprah, Dr. Oz. I'm sure with the new book, you'll be called upon to make many appearances. So without further ado, tell us about Grain Brain.
Thank you, Ron. Grain Brain really represents the culmination of really my whole thought process over the past couple of decades. You know, my mission has never been one to solely focus on treating neurological problems. 20 or 30 years ago, that was pretty well where I was steeped, and that was sort of just treating the symptoms of neurologic disease, the tremor of Parkinson's, the stiffness of the arms or legs in certain neurologic problems. I really felt that was not enough. It was pretty much like treating the smoke while we ignored the fire. So my mission has been over the years to try to figure out what is the proximate cause of these neurodegenerative conditions, and more importantly, once you identify that, what can be done to keep it from happening in the first place. So really what I've tried to carve out is a relatively new niche, and that is preventive medicine as it applies to neurodegenerative conditions. And for some reason, over the years, no one has really gone to that place. We hear of preventive lifestyle changes that people can engage for things like coronary artery disease, heart disease. What can a woman do to help reduce her risk for getting osteoporosis, etc.? But for reasons that are very unclear, the brain has always been left out of that discussion about preventing disease. And it's not for lack of information. The journal Lancet Neurology last year published an incredible report showing that a full 54% of cases of Alzheimer's disease are completely preventable if people would change important lifestyle issues. That's 2.6 million Americans of the 5.4 million Americans right now who have that diagnosis. Think of it. A disease that's costing us $200 billion a year, twice what we spend on heart disease, triple what we spend on treating cancer, can be significantly prevented if people were just to get the word in terms of what their lifestyle choices need to be.
And David, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, I try to follow the news about all these highly touted new Alzheimer's cures, breakthrough medications that are supposed to get rid of plaque in the brain. And it turns out that they crash and burn. They really don't really work when subject to clinical trials.
Well, not only do they not work, but in the most recent trial that was published last month in the New England Journal of Medicine, I wrote a Huffington Post article about it. The subjects actually on the treatment to get rid of this horrible protein in the brain called beta amyloid, those subjects actually declined more rapidly in terms of their brain function.
Yikes.
There's a big school of thought that's arising, recognizing that this protein, beta amyloid, in the brain is protective and is the brain's response. Beta amyloid, I don't mean to be too technical, but it's actually what we call an antimicrobial peptide, meaning it's like an antibiotic for the brain. There's a lot of work being done recognizing now that certain organisms may play a role in causing Alzheimer's, things like herpes simplex virus type 1, and also forms of chlamydia, not the STD. So it seems quite likely that the beta amyloid that everyone's trying to image and trying to get rid of is actually getting rid of other things.
So would it be akin to trying to fight a fire by, you know, observing that there's lots of smoke at the site of the fire and then taking a giant blower and trying to blow the smoke away, which, of course, would fan the flames of the fire?
Exactly. And, you know, the beta amyloid is actually the brain's response, the brain trying to protect itself. So when you get rid of that, you're creating a scenario where you will worsen. And that's exactly what happened as published in the New England Journal of Medicine. You know, it's been said that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And here is beta amyloid trying to get rid of the enemy, which are these invading bacteria and viruses. And so it is our friend. So we need to take a step back and recognize that lifestyle factors play a critical role in determining whether you are going to get Alzheimer's or you are not. And that is described in our most well-respected peer-reviewed literature. As a matter of fact, yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine...
I have it open in front of me. Great minds think alike.
Well, it's page 540.
I'm looking at it.
Glucose levels and risk of dementia.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Presumably, you know about this article, but you beat me to the punch.
This is the central thesis of our book, Grain Brain.
Great timing.
We've been talking about this for, as you know, I've been lecturing about the role of sugar in terms of how it binds to proteins in the brain, the relationship of blood sugar to risk for dementia, as well as degree of dementia, and you know there are studies that demonstrate that you can correlate a person's blood sugar measurement today and follow, for example, as published in the journal, New England Journal of Medicine, follow them for a period of time and determine who's going to get demented.
Now, what's interesting about that article, and I know you're going to allude to this, is that they're not just talking about diabetes. Now, a lot of people say, well, of course, if you have diabetes, then you're going to have problems. But, you know, the ordinary person who doesn't have diabetes, that's not a problem. But in this article, they specifically state that even in non-diabetics, because, you know, there's a continuum from you're perfectly normal to your full-blown diabetes, and a lot of Americans are, you know, sort of like an iceberg phenomenon. We see the tip of the iceberg. We don't see what's submerged under the water.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, you bring up a very good point that people think that, well, your blood sugar really doesn't matter if you're not diabetic. I mean, it's as if, you know, you're okay until your blood sugar is 126. That's when you're considered diabetic. But at 125, everything's fine. And what this is showing us, and it's certainly not the first study to demonstrate this, is that even lower levels of blood sugar are absolutely a threat to the brain. One study recently published looked at measuring people's blood sugars by a test called hemoglobin A1C, which is a measurement for your listeners of average blood sugar. And it correlated hemoglobin A1C with the size of the hippocampus, the brain's memory center, and show that even at hemoglobin A1C levels that every doctor would tell you are normal, like 5.6, 5.7, you were already at great risk for having shrinkage of your hippocampus, your brain's memory center. Now, you can argue however you want, but when it comes to your brain's memory center, size does matter. The smaller your hippocampus, you can't make up for that, no matter how hard you try. The smaller your hippocampus, the more compromised your memory will be. And in another study, they actually, in the journal Neurology from the American Academy of Neurology, they took a group of people, they came into the lab, they measured their fasting blood sugars, and they did an MRI of the brain and measured the size of the hippocampus. Then they came back 4 years later and again measured the size of the hippocampus. And what they found was really remarkable, that there was significant shrinkage of the brain even at blood levels that we would consider normal, 95 to 100, the brain is already starting to shrink. Carbohydrates, sugar, are directly toxic to the brain. That's the central thesis, along with gluten, of our new book, Grain Brain, and it was validated by this publication that came out yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine.
So, now, you know, when people talk about lifestyle, they talk about, you know, make sure you exercise, make sure that you don't smoke, get plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables, eat a lot of whole grains, avoid animal fat. That's actually been the party line when it comes to conventional suggestions about prevention of Alzheimer's and dementia. But you go way further in terms of advocating a much lower carbohydrate approach, right?
Well, halfway measures work halfway. And we have two schools of evidence that support the contention that carbohydrates are lethal for human physiology, and they are the science and our history. You know, for 99.9% of the time that we've been on this planet, we've been on a very high-fat, very, very low-carbohydrate diet. So we've actually selected out genetically those individuals who will thrive on that type of diet. You know, it's now popularized as being a paleo diet. The bottom line is that our society has become fat-phobic. There's nothing wrong with fat. Eat more fat. It's what your body needs. It is the carbohydrates that are oxidizing our tissues, that are leading to coronary artery disease, dementia, senile dementia, the Alzheimer's type, and really any degenerative process that you can think of caused by higher levels of carbohydrates.
Now, how would you square that with the meat antagonists, you know, the Caswell Esselsteins, the Dean Ornishes, who have such popular sway in America, the Neil Barnards, the people who urge us not only to avoid all animal fat, but to avoid fish and avoid eggs and avoid all dairy products. They're saying that's the pathway to longevity.
Well, I would say that, first of all, eating a diet that's very, very high in fat doesn't by default necessarily mean that you have to be eating a lot of meat. So what I am suggesting is really quite consistent, at least with Dr. Neil Barnard, and that is you can be vegan and still have a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet. Wonderful sources of fat are things like coconut oil, avocado, nuts, seeds.
And coconut oil demonstrated recently to have some anti-Alzheimer's effects, correct?
No question about it. Matter of fact, there's a proprietary medical food on the market that capitalizes on this whole notion that fat is good for the brain. But in July of 2007, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they actually put head-to-head a high-fat diet, which was specifically the Atkins diet, and compared it head-to-head with the Ornish diet. And this was over a 12-month period of time. What they found was, in all of the cardiovascular markers that are really important, that people think really are critical for determining risk, for example, for heart disease, the same issues relate to the brain. The high-fat, low-carb diet, the Atkins diet, won out every single time. And, you know, for example, even weight loss, the percentage of body fat lost eating high fat was 2.9% on the Atkins diet and about, as I recall, 1.3% on the, 1.5% on the Ornish program. When you look at things like triglycerides, a powerful risk marker for coronary artery disease, the triglycerides on a high fat diet, you'd think this would be not the case. On the Atkins high-fat diet, triglycerides came down 30 points. On the Ornish low-fat program, they came down half of that, 15 points. So really what we're learning is that the human body thrives on fat. And I think that, you know, even in terms of cardiovascular disease, as you recall, you well know this, earlier this week, George W. Bush had a stent placed in his heart. Don't take me to that place about him getting a stent, but regardless of that,
he has a tendency to act before he thinks,
we're
not going to go there, but here, yeah, but he listens to advice, but he's not exactly an out of the box critical thinker.
Yeah, well, with all due respect, but I'm just saying, the validity, how meaningful is getting a stent in terms of longevity? I think we could debate that, but here's the point. I'm watching this on the evening news, and the medical commentator on network news, the main commentator said, you know, I guess that means we sometimes pay for all those cheeseburgers that we ate in our younger years.
Right.
And Nancy Snyderman said, well, yes, and the take-home message is here that We've really got to be on a low, low fat diet and get that cholesterol down. And that flies in the face of at least the last 15 years worth of data. You know, it was in 2007 that an interventional trial was published in the respected New England Journal of Medicine head to head, low fat diet versus low carbohydrate diet. And in every cardiovascular risk parameter that you want to look at, whether it's HDL, LDL, total cholesterol, or even more importantly, C-reactive protein, the high-fat diet beat out the low-fat diet on every marker. So the science tells us eat high-fat and cut down on the carbs, whereas the U.S. Department of Agriculture that supports farmers would have us believe that we've got to be drinking orange juice and eating our whole grain breakfast every day, and it's killing people.
Yeah.
You know, in early 1990s, when the word got out that fat is bad, the rates of diabetes in America tripled. And, you know, we made this massive dietary shift. Everything was low fat this, low fat that. And if you're going to keep your protein consumption about the same, then the calories have to be made up somewhere. It's either fat, protein, or carbs. When you go low fat, you by default go high carb, and that is the worst diet for humans.
Well, you are a neurologist, and you've studied the brain very intensively and critically looked at many of the studies. Talk to us about the nature of fuel for the brain, carbohydrates versus fat, because a lot of people say, look, I'm feeling kind of brain dead. I need a candy bar. You know, it's going to give me a sugar rush so that at least I can start thinking, because everybody believes implicitly that the prime fuel for brain is sugar, and immediate rushes from sugar fuel your thinking process.
Well, we've all been told that the primary fuel, or even more eloquently, the fuel that the brain prefers, I love that one, is carbohydrates, basically sugar, glucose. And the reality of that situation is nothing, again, could be further from the truth. That's why, as you correctly mentioned, there are studies now looking at things like coconut oil and even a proprietary medical food on the market, giving people specific fat, beta-hydroxybutyrate, which your body can make from your body fat or dietary fat, because that is by far and away the most efficient fuel for the brain, creates more of what we call ATP, those molecules of energy, and does so far more efficiently by reducing the production of damaging free radicals. The human brain has been powered by fat for 99.9% of the time that we've been here. Now, you bring up a good point that people who basically are, you know, eating carbs day and night, having a bowl of cereal for breakfast with some fresh squeezed orange juice from Florida, and at lunch, you know, who knows what that is. The point is, you need to cut out the carbs and power your brain with fat. It's far more efficient, and the brain will work much better. But you can't do that overnight. If you go very low carb and increase your consumption of fat tomorrow, you're going to feel kind of crummy for a couple of weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, until you go through what's called keto adaptation. Once you keto adapt, your brain can remain totally functional and focused throughout the day on one meal, for example, a great breakfast of eggs covered in olive oil, a little goat's cheese, some toasted pumpkin seed on top, whatever, spinach, kale, broccoli. But the point is, fat for the brain is like an oil lamp burning oil, burning fat all day long at a constant, beautiful rate. What happens when you burn, when you're thriving on carbs, you know, you get a great surge of glucose in the morning following that high-carb breakfast, and then your insulin is secreted, and by 10 o'clock in the morning, that blood sugar is crashing, and you're in deep doo-doo.
Right.
You reach for either the coffee or whatever the vending machine happens to have, because at that point, you're no longer able to be selective and choose, make good food choices, because you're out of control. And that's unfortunately how many Americans live their lives. They have that mid-morning snack. Then at lunch, they go through the same process, and by midday, they're in trouble once again. You know, it's not written in the Talmud that we have to have 3 meals a day. I don't know who came up with it, but as a matter of fact, our bodies are designed to eat infrequently. You know, we're hunter-gatherers, and we can be perfectly okay going a day or two.
A paleo style of eating might be, you know, you don't sit around and look at the clock and say, okay, it's lunchtime. When food is available, you had often very big meals. And then you'd go a long period of time resting, or perhaps on the hunt, on the quest for additional food. And there might be periods of plenty alternating with periods of fasting, where when you fast, I mean, I think you might be well suited to explain this. When you fast, you actually go into a fat burning metabolism. That's a natural metabolism. And unfortunately, very few of us experience the process of fasting. We're constantly stuffing our faces.
Good point. And, you know, when you are fasting, after a period of time, it generally takes 2.5 to 3 days, you ultimately, especially if you're active, will deplete your body's sugar stores. Sugar is stored in the liver and in the muscles as something called glycogen, which you break down and you could use. But thereafter, you start to really mobilize fat, and it becomes a fuel for the brain that really unleashes the brain's potential. So it's interesting to note that in all of the world's major religions, there's a fast built into the culture. There's a fast of Yom Kippur, of Ramadan. Jesus fasted for 40 days when he was in the desert and came back and delivered his public sermon. So it really does help to recharge the brain. You know, we're not the fastest animal in the forest, nor are we the strongest, but we're probably, based on brain size, the most clever, although these days you wonder about how clever we really are. But that said, aside, it's always been our brain and powering our brain that's gotten us to survive, that's allowed us to survive. So we really need to get away from the notion that carbs are good for the brain. That is totally wrong. A very interesting report came to us from the Mayo Clinic earlier this year that demonstrated that those individuals on a high-fat, low-carb diet had a 44% risk reduction for becoming demented. And again, there's no treatment for Alzheimer's disease, none at all, as we have this conversation in 2013. There are drugs that are FDA approved, but the reality of the situation is they don't work. But doctors write them because what? We have nothing else that we can do for you, so here, take this pill. But my point is, that's when the barn door has already been left open. And I'm pleading, as John Kennedy said, that the time to fix the roof is when the sun is shining. We have this incredible opportunity today, so supported by peer-reviewed journals. Just yesterday, as we talked about, the article in the New England Journal, showing that low-carb, keeping your blood sugar low, will be the best thing you can possibly do for your brain. You know, my book isn't out for another 5 weeks, and it's now become the number 2 Amazon bestseller in dementia and in Alzheimer's.
And you can pre-order it, though. That's one of the reasons I had you on now.
That was a little plug for it. Thank you.
Yes.
Because I think people are absolutely desperate for this information, because, you know, when you take mom or dad to the doctor because he or she is suddenly missing his keys or going into a room, doesn't know why he went there, can't understand the plot of a TV show, there's nothing that mainstream medicine can offer to you. It's sad. I applaud the pharmaceutical companies for trying, but why not prevent the disease in the first place? Alzheimer's is preventable, and that really is, you know, a critical message.
You know, there are already certain medical conditions, but they're sort of orphan medical conditions for which a ketogenic diet is now advocated. Can you talk a little bit about childhood epilepsy? Because this notion of eating fats to the exclusion of carbohydrates is not so way out when it comes to the brain.
Well, no question. And again, it gets back to ultimately powering the mitochondria, the little energy particles in every nerve cell. Every neuron in your brain has thousands of these energy producers called mitochondria. And to make the mitochondria work better, you use fat as a fuel, because it does several things. It produces a higher level of energy, and it does so at a reduced production of damaging free radicals. But even more importantly, when the brain is powered with fat, when each and every brain cell is powered with fat as opposed to carbohydrate or sugar, it stimulates the mitochondria to grow, to replicate. It's called mitochondrial biogenesis. Beyond that, what is also critically important is when you're on this so-called ketogenic diet, eating more fat and cutting your carbs way down, it actually turns on your DNA to cause the production of a hormone that will grow new brain cells in your brain's memory center. Wow. You can grow new brain cells in your memory center. You get a second chance. So historically, I was actually asked this on Quora recently about the history of the ketogenic diet, ketogenic meaning fat-type diet, low-carb, high-fat. And the answer I think they were looking for was 1921, because in 1921, before we really had any drugs to treat epilepsy, researchers found that, in fact, when kids ate almost pure fat who had epilepsy and cut out their carbs, it was dramatically helpful in their epilepsy. Their rate of seizures would go down. And so the answer to the question was supposed to be 1921. And I said, no, this diet was actually discovered about 2.6 million years ago when we began hunting and gathering. but since that time, a lot of work has been done looking at the effectiveness of the ketogenic diet in terms of treating a variety of problems. As you probably know, there's a wonderful book that's come out. I'm actually holding a copy in my hand. This is audio, but here's the video for you. Cancer as a Metabolic Disease.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the Origin, Management, and Prevention of Cancer by Dr. Thomas Seyfried.
Yeah, and I heard him give an outstanding lecture on the subject of how we can slow and retard the growth of cancer with a very low, minimal carbohydrate diet.
Minimal carbohydrate, but high fat.
Yep.
Basically a ketogenic diet. Yep. Mm-hmm. I wrote a Huffington Post article about treating the most aggressive type of brain cancer called glioblastoma multiforme, the type that killed Senator Kennedy, Edward Kennedy, using an aggressive, low-carb, high-fat diet based upon Dr. Seyfried's research that he so wonderfully cites in his book. The point is that cancer cells do, in fact, thrive on a glucose-rich environment. And cancer cells, by and large, cannot metabolize fat. So the point is that they, cancer cells, can be starved by cutting off their sugar source and using fat to power the body, which is what the body wants in the first place. So it's actually a very intriguing metabolic trick to get rid of cancer, maybe as an adjunct to treat along with other more mainstream approaches. You know, when a person has cancer, what we doctors do to try to see, for example, how big the tumor has become or not, or has it spread to another part of the body, is we do what's called a PET scan. And a specific scan done, PET scan for cancer, actually uses what's called FDG, fluorodeoxyglucose. It's a radioactive glucose. And why does it show you where the cancer is? Because the cancer cells suck up glucose. You shoot some glucose into that person's vein, and it lights up because cancer is just...
Goes right to the cancer.
We starve the cancer cells but leave the body cells perfectly fine by putting people on a ketogenic diet. We do this every single day. We treat Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, with a ketogenic diet. The laboratory studies using this have been profound, almost arresting Lou Gehrig's disease by using a ketogenic diet, which cuts down free radical production, allows neurons to survive, and powers their mitochondria with the right fuel. Let me just say one last thing. The mitochondria, these little particles that live inside every neuron, aside from producing energy, one of their other very important roles is they ultimately determine which cell will live or die. In the DNA of your cells, there's a program that initiates what's called apoptosis, or cellular death, suicide. But the mitochondria control the genes that regulate whether that cell will live or die. The mitochondria are wielding the sword of Damocles. So we've got to be kind to our mitochondria, and they want to burn fat.
Hmm. Well, there's also this concept that's now being popularized. You know, we know about type 1 diabetes. That means insulin-dependent diabetes. You need to use insulin shots several times daily to keep your blood sugar stable. Then there's type 2 diabetes, or so-called non-insulin-dependent diabetes, where you tend to get fat and you use oral medications, and that can often be cured with the right kind of diet and exercise and supplements. But then there's this concept of type 3 diabetes, and I know you allude to it in Grain Brain. Talk to us about how that might influence memory and dementia.
Well, I think the terminology arose because of what you and I have been talking about, and that is this profound relationship between sugar and insulin metabolism and brain health. That's really where the term came from. We cannot turn our backs on this information. And moving forward, this is a powerful, powerful leverage point, recognizing that even mild perturbations in blood sugar metabolism and insulin metabolism have a profound role to play in terms of choosing who gets diabetes and therefore who gets Alzheimer's or who doesn't. Even long before the blood sugar begins to elevate, when people are eating high carbohydrates and cutting back on fat, what happens is to control that blood sugar, the pancreas starts to work overtime, secretes more insulin. But as that happens and the insulin levels start to climb, the cells become less responsive to the insulin and cannot further bring in the blood sugar because the insulin starts to become the cells become less sensitive to the insulin. And we call that insulin resistance. Mind you, the blood sugar is still normal, but now we're getting higher and higher levels of insulin, a syndrome called insulin resistance. So even insulin resistance has now been correlated with dramatically higher levels, or rather risk levels, of becoming an Alzheimer's patient. So these are people who have normal blood sugar, and yet just because the pancreas is working higher and their cells are becoming less sensitive to insulin, that in and of itself becomes a powerful risk factor for developing a disease for which there is no cure. So, this is a scary business. People really need to understand that we have absolutely almost complete control over whether we become insulin resistant and even beyond that, whether we become diabetic. The day the doctor says that you are diabetic, you've doubled your chances for a disease for which there is no cure. Alzheimer's disease risk doubles when you are now diabetic. And type 2 diabetes is by and large a choice. It's a lifestyle issue. If you eat high carbs and low fat, you are dramatically increasing your risk of becoming a diabetic and doubling your risk for this horrible, horrible disease. And you know, just to be very candid with you, this is a situation, Alzheimer's, that I deal with every single day in my practice. And it's not just the patient, it's the families that are devastated. And truth be known, my father has Alzheimer's disease, so I really understand emotionally what it's like to deal with a parent who's suffering with this issue, and further, recognize the fear that may be imparted in people when they know that our primary relative now has this problem in terms of their risk. So the mission is to not see things as they are and ask why, but rather as they could be and say, why not? Why not get out there and, using the most well-respected peer-reviewed literature available to us today, demonstrate that we don't have to get to this place where we have an incurable disease. It is absolutely all about lifestyle choices. It's not about waiting for the other shoe to drop and then hoping your doctor has a magic pill.
You know, we have 60 or 70 or 80 million baby boomers who are aging now, and they, like you, may have elderly parents who are showing signs of dementia or Alzheimer's disease. So this is a huge, huge concern. You yourself, you've embraced this lifestyle, this type of diet. I've known you for many years. I don't think you were a total ketogenic diet fan 20 or 25 years ago when I first met you. What changes has this created for you in your own personal life? Because I think you pretty much adhere to the program. You walk the walk. You don't just talk the talk. You actually have embraced this program for yourself.
Well, truthfully, to get back in dealing with patients, it certainly instills the urgency and the importance of this information in terms of me getting out to the public. But on a personal basis, I'm in the same place as their families. I know what it's like. So I fast frequently. Generally on a Saturday, I might not eat for the entire day. And I'm thrilled at how I can remain so cognitively sharp, mm-hmm. and go for my run and exercise at peak performance burning fat and not relying on carbohydrate.
What is your height and weight, by the way? People,
I am 5'7", used to be 5'7 and a half, but I'm 5'7", and I'm about 152, 148 to 152.
Okay, so you're by no means emaciated. I mean, you're a slim guy. Yeah, you're a muscular 5'7". Okay.
So, I am thrilled with, my athletic performance. I try to run a half marathon every year, and I know that you do triathlons, and there's a big concern, which is totally unfounded, that you'll lose your
athletic. Right, that you need to carb load, otherwise you're going to bonk.
And that is profoundly erroneous. I mean, there are books written on reaching your maximum oxygen utilization being amplified by burning ketones. You know, in your body, as you sit here right now, or maybe not you, but other, typically people have about 2,000 calories worth of carbohydrate to burn. And you have about, the average person has 40,000 calories of fat available. So, where is the fuller tank that you want to tap into? That said, you don't just suddenly shut off your carbs and think you're going to burn fat and go out and run a 10K. It doesn't work that way. It takes, as I mentioned, a couple of good, solid, low-carb, higher-fat weeks to keto-adapt. Then once you do, you become this warrior. You become that hunter-gatherer who could track game for 3 days nonstop. You gain this level of cognitive performance that is breathtaking. Memory function improves dramatically. You don't lose things anymore. You can do without sleep one night and it's not the end of the world. You cannot eat for a day and everything is fine. So it's absolutely revolutionary, having come full circle in terms of what humans have eaten for 99.9% of our time, to have adopted the normal standard American diet, SAD, to having gone back now to honoring my genome in terms of how my DNA, your DNA, was selected over the 2.6 million years we've been here to thrive on this type of nutrition. The Integrative Healthcare Symposium in February of 2014 coming up, we're actually starting the symposium with a debate of vegan diet, Mediterranean diet, that'd be Stephen Sinatra, and myself talking about a fairly paleo diet, in other words, very high in fat and very low in carbs. But, the thing is, when we debate, I think it's going to be really interesting because I think it's going to be televised. What I'm advocating here is not that we eat pork rinds all day.
Get a bacon cheeseburger and throw away.
Not in the least. What I'm advocating is simply a higher fat consumption. And, when we read the China study, which was an excellent text, and many people concluded from reading the China study that if you eat meat, you're going to get cancer, your risks are higher. And I think that's very unfair to have drawn that conclusion from the research, which was excellent research that was done. Because when you look at epidemiologically people who eat meat versus those who don't eat meat, that's not fair. It's like saying, we're going to look at the effect of alcohol on health, and we're going to lump a Chardonnay in the same category as Jack Daniels in the alcohol department, or even a red wine along with some cheap scotch,
or Thunderbird.
Yeah, Thunderbird, MD 2020. How do I know that? But the point is,
45.
malt liquor. If you do that, in terms of if you break down what it means to be a meat eater, I think you're in for some big surprises, because 99% of the meat that is available, that is generally consumed in the world, is awful stuff. And I am not advocating that we eat grain-fed
food. That's a good point. That's an
genetically modified high omega-6 corn or soy, because there's no alchemy that takes place. You don't change garbage into gold. So garbage into the cattle is garbage out in terms of eating that meat. I wouldn't go near that stuff because you're likely to get sick, who knows with what. And I believe that that is what explains these statistics demonstrating that eating a lot of meat, taking all comers, is associated with health risks. That's totally expected.
I will give you some ammo for your upcoming debate with people who were advocates of the China study. So-called China study. It's more of a series of observations. There was recently a study that shows that when they increase the meat intake, in Asia, among Asians, that there was actually an improvement in mortality risk. So that's kind of a fascinating wrinkle to the China study, because when they began to change the diet and began to incorporate more animal protein, mortality went down. So I think, you know, that study needs to be re-examined. So the book
tell that to me, but that's a very good point. I wonder when that actually took place, because if it was decades ago, it would have been prior to, you know, all of this grain-fed beef with GMO and who knows what else.
And industrialization and pollution and lifestyle factors, many other factors that have changed the statistics in China. It's unfair to look at impoverished people working hard in fields who are eating vegetarian diet and comparing them to modern urban dwellers. All right, well, when's the book coming out? It's coming out in a few weeks, so you can pre-order. You can go to the usual sources. You can go to Amazon. Amazon has it up. And you've got a website. Tell us about that.
Drperlmutter.com or grainbrainbook.com, our websites. I post a lot of great stuff, as do you, on Facebook.
And my Facebook. Your posts are fantastic. I love them.
Oh, thank you.
So friend Dr. Perlmutter on Facebook, because you get a lot of good stuff.
And it's interesting what I'm noticing is the more scientific are my postings, the more people read them and like them. It's, you know, people are desperate for the science. You know, you can put up a cute picture of this or that and, you know, people look at it. But for example, today I actually posted the New England Journal of Medicine article that was published yesterday about becoming demented by having a higher blood sugar. And people are thrilled. They're absolutely all over this information. You know, knowledge is very, very empowering. And so Facebook me, friend me, and it's David Perlmutter, MD.
Yeah, and the other point to be made is people aren't getting the knowledge through the mainstream media, through the usual channels. That's becoming extinct and irrelevant, and it's through guerrilla sources of information like Dr. Perlmutter, and hopefully via podcasts like this on Intelligent Medicine, that you can get the real science and a critical look at some of the things that, you know, we mistakenly take for granted, like low-fat diets.
Well, let me just say that you know, the word doctor in Latin does not mean healer. It means teacher. And, you know, that's the mission. And that said, Ron Hoffman, you've done a heck of a job over the years. And, you know, who knows how many lives you have touched by being this vanguard and getting out there and standing up to, you know, with your beliefs to what mainstream has been feeding Americans and really the world. So, you know, please know that I commend you for that, because it's a great service and you've done a great job.
Well, thank you very much. We're a mutual admiration society. Dr. David Perlmutter's new book is Grain Brain, and it's a must read because it's got great science and it's always a fascinating read. Thank you very much for joining us. All the best. I look forward to seeing you on major media outlets, because I think you're going to do an outstanding book tour behind this great new book.
Thanks again, Ron. You're the best.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.